So I'll just move quickly through the slides. And then I'm happy to answer questions. Sir, as Mitchell mentioned, the study was published in The Lancet last week. So if there are questions about the details, there's a lot of information there, too. So first, just to start, this was the Bangkok-Tenofovir study. It was an HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis trial among people who inject drugs. This was a collaboration between the Bangkok Metropolitan Administration, the city government of Bangkok, and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Also, the Thailand Ministry of Public Health was part of the study as well. Okay, so this was a phase 3 randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled, endpoint-driven trial. 2,413 HIV uninfected people who inject drugs enrolled into the study and were randomized 1-to-1 to receive either tenofovir or placebo and were followed until the endpoint target, which was 40 incident HIV infections, was reached. A unique feature of this trial was that participants were able to choose either daily, directly observed taking of study drug or monthly visits without DOT and could switch at the monthly visits. And we had annual independent data and safety monitoring board safety reviews and one interim review by our DSMB. Okay. All right. Are we advancing? There we go. Oversight, we had ethical review committees in Thailand and the United States reviewing the protocols, the consent forms, and other trial materials. We had a CRO that provided oversight and assured good clinical practice compliance, and then we had the independent data and safety monitoring board that I mentioned. Recruitment, we did this, we put posters and brochures describing the study. They were posted in drug treatment clinics in Bangkok. Staff was available at the clinics to discuss the trial with people who were interested in joining. We also did presentations about the study at several drop-in centers around Bangkok. Potential participants received an explanation of study objectives, design, eligibility criteria, activities, and procedures. Services offered to volunteers in the study. There was monthly HIV testing, risk reduction education and counseling. Methadone maintenance treatment was available. There was matrix model methamphetamine treatment, condoms and counseling on use, free contraception and counseling, social services and primary medical care with referrals for secondary and tertiary care, bleach to clean injection equipment. There were a number of activities we went through at the beginning of the study in the year or 2 years preceding the study to involve community. We had a series of focus group discussions, outreach to organizations working with people who inject drugs and other communities at risk for HIV/AIDS, and then we had a community group that we worked with before, during, and ongoing after the trial as well. And I'll move through them quickly. We conducted a series of focus group discussions in July and August of 2004, about a year before the study started. There were a number of issues that came up about the trial, questions about the information we were providing was thought to be somewhat clear, but not exhaustive, so we redid our educational information about the study. Participants had questions about why tenofovir was selected for the study, questions about risk and benefits, and there were certainly a lot of concerns about side effects to tenofovir and then also access to HIV treatment and care. We reached out to local community-based organizations, government and non-governmental organizations as well. We met with representatives from 16 of these groups, distributed draft protocols, consent forms, educational materials, got comments on these documents that helped us with our eventual presentation to the ethical committees. And then we discussed potential implementation of tenofovir as an HIV prevention tool. Met with community representatives at several of the drop-in centers around Bangkok. And all of these activities informed the development of the protocol, the consent forms, and the consent process that we use, and also education materials. Okay. And then we had a community relations committee that's worked with us from before the trial, during the trial, and continues on. It has at least one person who injects drugs from each of the 17 BMA drug treatment clinics. Also, these members are some HIV-infected, some uninfected men and women, as well as some family members that join and community leaders. We meet every 2 months with this community relations committee. And a number of concerns have been raised, confidentiality, questions about study procedures, police harassment, incarceration, side effects, medical care, compensation, and also post-trial access to tenofovir. Okay. So I'll move on quickly because I know time is limited and just into the study. So this is a map of Bangkok, and that's the Chao Phraya River running north to south through the city. The red dots are the 17 represent the 17 drug treatment clinics where the trial was conducted. Most of our laboratory testing was done at the central Bangkok Diagnostic Lab right there, and then we also did some of the CD4 counts and viral load testing up at the CDC lab north of Bangkok in Nonthaburi. The activities, just an overview of the activities that went on at the monthly visits. We would do pill counts with the volunteers, and they would record these whether they had taken study drug or not, and whether they were on DOT or non-DOT on a study drug diary card. Participants were assessed for adverse events. They received adherence and risk reduction counseling. They also received pre- and post-test HIV counseling, and we did oral fluid HIV testing at the monthly visits. Women had urine pregnancy tests monthly visits. Then at the 3 monthly visits, we did those activities, plus we did a risk behavior assessment using an audio computer self-interview, and then blood was collected for safety and HIV testing. I mentioned the daily visits. These visits were very quick. The volunteers would come into the clinic. They would present themselves at a window. The nurse would identify them, ask if there were any issues, any problems, and if there was nothing going on, they would receive a dose of study drug, and then they would leave. This is a participant flow chart. We screened 4,094 individuals. 1,492 were ineligible, and the most common reason people were ineligible is we had some fairly strict laboratory entry criteria. That was the most common reason people weren't able to join. There were 447, or about 11% of those who screened, were HIV positive. 233 had hepatitis B surface antigen, and then there were other reasons. There were 189 volunteers who presented for screening but just did not return for follow-up. So that left us 2,413 who were randomized. 1,204 were assigned to tenofovir. 1,209 were assigned to placebo. We found out that two of those volunteers were actually HIV infected at enrollment. So for the modified intent to treat analysis, those two were taken out. And you can see we had fairly balanced total person years of follow-up, 4,843 in the tenofovir group, 23 in the placebo group. Okay, so we enrolled 2,413 participants. The most common reasons people couldn't enroll were laboratory abnormalities or HIV infection. The median age was 31 years, 80% were male, 48% had a primary school education or less. The randomization distributed participants evenly by sex, age, education, and risk behaviors. I've skipped over some slides, but this sort of summarizes the information. We had a total of 355, or about 15% of volunteers who were lost. So they would have come for a visit and then disappeared. We did a lot of work trying to find volunteers through peers, through family. Often we would find out that people had been incarcerated. But sometimes they just disappeared for whatever reason, and we weren't able to find them. So 355, or about 15% over the 7-year trial. There were 107 total deaths, similar numbers and causes for those randomized to tenofovir and placebo. The most common cause of death was overdose, followed by traffic accidents, which is a big public health problem here in Thailand, and sepsis. Okay. Risk behaviors were similar among those randomized to tenofovir and placebo, which is important. Risk behaviors, including injecting, sharing, and reporting sex with more than one partner, declined significantly during follow-up. We used a proportional hazard model to look at what risk factors predicted HIV infection. And what we found in our multivariable model was at young age 20 to 29, reporting that you'd shared needles and incarceration were significantly associated with HIV infection. Reporting sex with a casual partner, a male reporting sex with a male partner, or reporting sex more than multiple partners was not associated, did not increase your risk for HIV infection. One slide on adherence. On the left side, those box plots there just basically show us that the adherence was similar, reported adherence was similar among those randomized to tenofovir and placebo, which is important. Median adherence was high, reported median adherence was high, 94% in the tenofovir group, 94.3% in placebo. And then that pie chart on the bottom shows that overall, participants were in DOT follow-up 87% of the time that they were on the study. DOT means that they were coming into the clinic daily. It doesn't necessarily mean that they were taking study drug every single day. Volunteers who were on that, they were coming daily, but they could miss visits and then come back for a few days and then miss days as well. Okay, so this is the efficacy results that we reported in the Lancet article. So in the participants in the intention to treat analysis, this includes everybody who was randomized. Among those who were randomized to receive tenofovir, there were 17 HIV infections. That provides that gives an incidence of 0.35. Among those who were randomized to placebo, there were 35 HIV infections. That gives an incidence of 0.73 for an efficacy estimate of 51.8 or 52% and a p-value of 0.01, so a very significant result. In the modified intention to treat, where we took out those two who were infected at baseline, so this looks specifically at those who became infected during follow-up, there were the tenofovir group remained the same, 17 infections and a 0.35 incidence. The two who were infected at baseline were both in placebo, so we take them out, 33 infections in the placebo group for an incidence of 0.68 and an efficacy that we reported in the manuscript of 48.9% or 49%, and again, a p-value that is strongly significant at 0.01. This is what the Kaplan-Meier curve looks like. It just shows it. Interesting, there wasn't a whole lot of separation in the first 3 years, the 36 months of the trial, probably because we didn't have enough endpoints to show a difference, but then it just widens on out, and it keeps getting wider as time goes by, which is reassuring. Okay, we did a couple secondary analyses, and I'm not going to spend much time on. These were analyses where we tried to focus in on people who we had evidence that were very adherent, and we had a definition for adherent with taking study drug at least 71% of days with no more than two consecutive days off. And when we used that, we saw the efficacy go from 46% up to 56%, and then we also included looking for detectable tenofovir in the plasma, the efficacy estimate increased to 73.5% or 74%. So for that population that was very adherent and had tenofovir in the blood, our best estimate of efficacy was about 74%. And we did a similar study looking at drug level data, a case unmatched case control study. And when we did this study, we found a couple things that are interesting. One, adherence over among those who were not HIV infected was 67%. So that's pretty good. And that when we did the case control, when did the odds ratio, we found a reduction in risk of 70%, which is reassuring because it's consistent with what we saw previous secondary analysis. So we reckon that efficacy for those who adhere is somewhere in the range of 70-80%, around that range. We also did genotyping, and the subtypes are similar to what we would expect to find in Thailand. No surprises there, and we were very happy to see that there were no resistance mutations associated with tenofovir among those volunteers who became, among those 17 on tenofovir who became HIV infected. Adverse events, again, there was good information here. As with the other trials, the other PrEP trials, we did not find any evidence of severe, of serious safety events. As far as all adverse events, they were evenly distributed between tenofovir and placebo, same with serious adverse events, deaths. The one thing we did find was that volunteers randomized to tenofovir were more likely to report nausea than those who were on placebo. And the next slide shows you a chart of what that looks like. It looks like most of that was in that first two months. the blue line there is the tenofovir group, and you can see there's more nausea in the first month and the second month that comes down, and then there's no difference between the randomization and reports of nausea. Then we took a quick look at laboratory results, and we were very happy to see there was no difference in the creatinine results between those in the tenofovir group and those in the placebo group. We did find that low-level ALT, it's a transaminase, was slightly higher in the tenofovir group than placebo, but when you look at the actual values, the difference was very small and it didn't increase over time, which is reassuring. So in conclusion, we provide the first evidence that daily oral tenofovir, when used in combination with other HIV prevention strategies, reduce the risk of HIV infection among people who inject drugs. Once daily, oral tenofovir decreased the risk of HIV infection 49% among people who inject drugs when provided with a package of HIV prevention services at Drug Treatment Bangkok. The protective efficacy increased with improved adherence. And consistent with other PrEP trials, we did not identify any significant safety concerns associated with daily use of tenofovir. Participant reports of injecting and sharing declined during follow-up, and this may be due to the HIV preventive services provided as part of the study. So we now have evidence that pre-exposure prophylaxis can prevent both sexual and parenteral HIV transmission. And that's my last slide, Mitch. So thank you all.
Great, Mike. Mike, thank you so much. We've had a number of questions that have already come in on the chat function and via email. Again, I'll remind people that you can do it on the web interface or by sending an email to avac@avac.org. And we're going to turn to those questions in just a minute. But first, I'm going to turn it over to Dawn Smith, also of the CDC, but based in Atlanta, who has been involved not only in the PrEP trials themselves, but in developing interim guidance from the CDC. And she's going to provide some insights on that process now. So, Dawn. And on *7 to unmute your line. Dawn, are you there?
Sorry, yeah.
No problem. There you are.
I was on mute. Okay, so based on the trial results that you've just seen, CDC also issued interim guidance for PrEP use, and on this table you'll see the sum of the three interim guidances that we have put out for PrEP use, one for MSM, one for high-risk heterosexuals, and one for injection drug users being prescribed PrEP. And as you can see for IDU, we added some suggested criteria for determining which IDU PrEP may be appropriate for. And at the bottom right, what other services need to be provided to injection drug users as they're prescribed PrEP. All of the issues about how you prescribe PrEP are the same across the three populations in terms of documenting that people are HIV negative before you begin PrEP, making sure that there are no signs or symptoms of acute infection, and if they are, that appropriate laboratory testing is done to exclude acute HIV infection, assessing renal function, other medications and health conditions that might contraindicate the use of Truvada, and documenting hepatitis B virus infection and vaccination status. Having active hepatitis B infection is not a contraindication to using Truvada for PrEP, but it is something that a provider should be aware of, particularly when discontinuing Truvada. And for patients who have no evidence of previous hepatitis B infection or who have no evidence of vaccination, they should be provided hepatitis B vaccination. For all groups, we're recommending oral daily doses of Truvada for PrEP. In the case of IDU, although tenofovir only was used in the trial, because most IDU are also sexually active, and because Truvada is has a labeling indication in the United States for use for the prevention of sexually acquired HIV infection, as well as the fact that Truvada contains exactly the same dose of tenofovir that was proven effective among IDU, we have recommended Truvada for use in injection drug users, as well as other populations at sexual risk. The follow-up schedule is the same for all three of the populations. Next slide. Because injection drug users are at risk from both their sexual, are potentially at risk for HIV infection, both by sexual practice and injection practices, we also want to be very clear to providers that in addition to providing PrEP and screening for STDs, that there are other things that need to be part of the mix that are provided to any injection drug users who receive PrEP. And those include access to substance abuse treatment and relapse prevention services, including medication-assisted therapy, such as methadone or buprenorphine. Access to new sterile needles and to clean drug preparation equipment as it is available and consistent with local laws and regulations. In places where needle and syringe exchanges are available, that's one option. In places where providers can prescribe syringes or persons are, can legally acquire them at pharmacies without a prescription, that's another option. They should all be, persons receiving PrEP should all receive condoms and support for their consistency and correct use. Sexual health services, including STD diagnosis and treatment, and for women, especially family planning services. Any indicated social services, financial services, housing services, and other key social services that are particularly relevant for some injection drug users. Any indicated mental health services, and all of the services provided to injection drug users should be integrated, the PrEP services as well as health care for any other conditions, for example, TB, hepatitis B or C infection, or pregnancy. Those are my two slides.
Great. Dawn, thank you so much. I want to thank Dawn and Mike, and we will be turning to questions in just a minute. But before we do, we wanted to provide some time for Daniel Raymond, the policy director at the Harm Reduction Coalition and the co-convener of today's call, to provide some comments from his perspective. So, Daniel, over to you.
Thanks, Mitchell. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. So I have some broad comments in two arenas. One is the overall context of this study, and the other is some of the implications and what we can learn and take away from it. So I wanted to first acknowledge the particular policy and governmental context that this study was conducted in. It was launched at a time where the federal government of the United States, through Congress, maintained a funding ban on syringe exchange programs, which it currently has today, and that the Thai government also did not allow for syringe exchange programs. But most importantly, 2003, a couple of years before the launch of this study, the then Prime Minister of Thailand declared a war on drugs, which resulted in 2,500 extrajudicial killings of drug users and dealers. And that was a human rights catastrophe that cast a shadow over what any kind of study design and launch for anything involving substance use could look like. On the one hand, in that context, it's really remarkable that the study was able to do the groundwork in terms of community engagement, recruitment, and retention. on the other hand, I think that it also speaks to a broader lesson that the fundamental HIV prevention intervention must be at the structural level to create policy environments that don't drive infection, but in fact mitigate the spread of HIV. And in the case of people who inject drugs, and more broadly other marginalized populations, we face policy environments around the world that show resistance to proven interventions for people who inject drugs that would include syringe exchange, syringe access, opioid substitution treatment. We also see in many parts of the world compulsory detention work camps masquerading as drug treatment. We see criminalization, people added to registries, pervasive stigma, and social exclusion. And I want to refer people to an excellent blog post by Dana Wolf of the Open Society Foundation's International Harm Reduction Development Program on Huffington Post that lays out some of these challenges in terms of thinking about how we consider the biomedical research in the context of these policy environments. Given those contextual factors, I also wanted to talk for a moment about what we can learn from this important study. And I think that there's several key issues even beyond the clear value in terms of efficacy. So the first would be the under study conditions, they achieved a very high retention rate and a very high adherence rate. And I think that this is important because a lot of assumptions have gotten made both in the research front and the clinical front about the degree to which people with substance use histories will be retained and can adhere to protocols. What this also demonstrates indirectly is a strong case for the feasibility of antiretroviral therapy for HIV-positive people who inject drugs. So given that high adherence rate, that this was safe and well-tolerated, albeit in an HIV-negative population, I think that this adds to the argument that in places with significant HIV populations associated with transmission to injection drug use, that it's really necessary and feasible to scale up access to antiretroviral therapy. I think the third lesson is that this gives us reassurance in terms of the use of PrEP for people at dual risk through injection drug use and sexual risk. For example, men who have sex with men who also inject drugs. So after the initial PrEP results for sexual transmission come out, there was a bit of an asterisk hanging over what this means for people who might also either regularly or occasionally inject drugs, men who have sex with men, sex workers, and so forth. And I think these results give us reassurance that the injection drug use should not preclude candidates for PrEP from receiving adequate treatment or prophylaxis. The fourth lesson is thinking through what these kind of strategies look like from an HIV prevention lens versus a drug user health lens. And to that point, I just want to highlight the high rate of death due to overdose amongst the study population during the duration of the trial. And as we think through our approaches, taking a broader drug user health lens can address not just the HIV risk, but the multiple threats to the health of this population. And finally, I think that this study gives us a solid foundation to extend some of this research in terms of looking at translatability and really understanding what are the factors that lend to analyses of cost effectiveness, including comparative cost effectiveness of PrEP in combination with other interventions versus other modes of HIV prevention, looking at what the relative ingredients of the trial design, such as the role of directly observed therapy, contributed to the outcomes, and how the dynamics in terms of substance use rates, injecting rates, shared syringe rates can reflect or not reflect the relative epidemiologic profile in other areas. I think that there's a lot of opportunity for some robust calculations and modeling analyses that could further serve to advance arguments for scaling up multiple forms of HIV prevention strategies for people who inject drugs in many parts of the world. And I'll leave my comments at that. Thank you, Rachel.
Great. Thank you. Excuse me, Ray. Daniel, that was terrific. Thank you so much for that. Again, let me remind people that you can put your questions on the web interface with ReadyTalk, and we have a lot of great questions that have come in. You can email them to avac@avac.org, and we'll open the lines in just a minute by hitting *7. But a number of questions have come in, and Daniel, you really provided some great context for the discussion. I do want to turn to a couple of questions for you, Mike, about the trial itself. And you talked both in the presentation and in the previous data coming out about directly observed use of PrEP. And I think a lot of questions have come up just on the chat function here about what exactly directly observed meant. If you could just review about, you know, our normal conception is watching people take a pill, but if you could describe what happened there, and also on a related area about the incentives for people to come back to engage in the trial, if you could provide some insights there about what actually participants were getting from a financial incentive perspective.
Sure. So thanks, Mitch. And that was an excellent comment by Daniel. Thank you very much for that. I think just to emphasize a couple of things he said, and I'll come to your questions as well, Mitch, but, you know, the retention in the study was very good, about 85% over the 7 years of the trial, and adherence, reported adherence was good. And a lot of these volunteers, a lot of the participants were coming in every day, day after day, for many years to participate in the study. And I think I've gotten questions since the Lancet article came out, how could this be implemented in place among drug users, and I think this trial provides a good example of when a community understands the situation and is very motivated, people will follow up, and it is a testament to that. Just to mention the situation among our participants also in Bangkok as far as needle use goes. So it's true that in Thailand it is illegal to give needles to someone to inject drugs. So we weren't able to provide needles in the clinics as part of this study. But speaking, needles are available at low cost without a prescription at pharmacies that are on many corners in Bangkok and easy to find. And speaking with the volunteers and speaking with our community group, we were consistently told that purchasing new sterile needles and syringes was not a problem. Access was not a problem. People knew where to go. As the trial moved along, actually, there began to be sort of pilot programs in several of the drop-in clinics around the city, the IDU drop-in clinics, where you could go pick up a coupon. A pharmacy that could provide clean needles and was willing to do it was identified. You could get a coupon and then go to the pharmacy and pick up a clean needle. So that, among our participants in the study, the situation is different in every city and in every part of Thailand for sure, but that was the setting here. And we see it, when we look at reports of sharing, in our early trials we would see 30% or more volunteers reported they had shared. And by the end of this study, reports of sharing were down to 1 or 2%. And we see it with the incidence as well. In our previous work here, we were seeing an incidence of 5.86% per year among participant IDU participants in clinical trials. And in this trial, in those receiving tenofovir, the incidence was 0.35. So it's about a 95% reduction in the past decade. DOT, just to mention how DOT works. So the clinics are methadone treatment clinics, so they're set up you can walk in off the street right to a window and receive your methadone right there, and we adapted that to just provide study drug at the window. So we were able to do it very efficiently. We thought at the beginning of the trial maybe 40-50% of the volunteers would choose to have DOT, but in fact it ended up, as I mentioned, about 80% or better coming in for DOT. We did everything we could to make those visits very efficient. Now, as I said, when people are on DOT, it wasn't like sometimes we think with tuberculosis treatment that you come every single day, and that wasn't necessarily true. We wanted volunteers to come as much as they could, but we also wanted to be open, understanding that people have other issues as well. And so volunteers would miss days. They might miss, several days at a time, and we would just say, please come back when you can, and volunteers would. About compensation for the trial, it's it's customary in clinical research that you provide some compensation to compensate volunteers or participants for their travel and something for their time. So what we provided in this study for the daily visits, we provided 70 baht, which is about $2. And we came up with that thinking about transportation. The easiest way to get around Bangkok, or one of the easiest ways to get around Bangkok, is by motorcycle taxis. And they're 20 to 30 baht for a ride one way, and two ways we figured is about 50, 60 baht. So we figured that would be reasonable. We actually started off the trial at 50 baht, and there was a lot of discussion with our community group that that was insufficient, and it went back and forth for a year or two, and then we finally increased to 70 baht. And then for the monthly visits where we would do the HIV testing, the pregnancy testing, and then every 3 months we would draw blood, we provided 350 baht for those visits. And that we came up with based on what other research trials are providing for compensation. We saw everything from 350 to 400 to 500 baht for these more involved visits. We felt 350 baht was about right. Our community group thought it was a little bit low, but that's what we went with.
great. Oh, go ahead.
Okay.
No, that's great, Mike. Thank you. So one of the questions that's come up several times already, too, is what's next, both for those trial participants and in Thailand generally, and I guess following on that incentive-based, directly observed-based approach, what is the plan for following up those participants in the study post-trial, and what are the kinds of conversations that you're aware of happening in Thailand now about what would come next as a possible translation of these results into practice?
So, right. So for trial participants, you know, when they joined the trial, we said that if we found efficacy and we found that it was safe, we would provide tenofovir for 1 year. So that's what we're going to do for the volunteers in this study, and we're just getting ourselves organized and having everything put together to get that started as soon as we possibly can. You know, there's sort of a interest also in trying to make this look like a pilot study or provide some information about implementation, and we're going to try to do that, but you know, we can't quite do everything. So our focus is to provide participants 1 year of tenofovir, and then we're during this interim, the Ministry of Public Health here in Thailand will begin discussions on PrEP among people who inject drugs, but also the overall issue of PrEP. There's the government or the Ministry of Public Health is going to be reviewing its treatment guidelines here in the next few months. And while they're doing that, they're also going to consider including a piece on prevention as well. So, you know, it's a challenging question to deal with. You know, different countries, Thailand, other countries are going to have different priorities. Thailand relatively recently increased their CD4 count recommendation for ARVs from 200 to 350, which is good news. But it also brings, you know, it brings challenges to providing ARVs now to a larger population of HIV-infected persons. So there's a context that this will be considered in, and the ministry will be dealing with those issues in the next few months.
Great. Thanks, Mike. And I, just to remind people that Thailand was also host to a small cohort within the IPREC study of PrEP amongst men who have sex with men and transgender women. So it's one of those countries where you do see PrEP in two populations. One other question that's come up a lot, both on the chat function, but also last week when the results first came out, is to understand better, if you could help us, two things I'll just mention now and let you respond to both. One is, what might explain this seemingly non-efficacy in the first 3 years before you saw any effect? And I'm wondering if you and any of the trial team have hypotheses to explain that aspect. And the other one is related to risk. And a number of questions here have come in about how do we know what exposed risk was like for these trial participants between the potential for exposure through needles and potential exposure through sex, and is there a way to understand which risk might have brought infection?
Right. So those are two important questions. So first, about the way the curves looked, that there wasn't much of a separation for the first 3 years. So the first thing to say is the fact that it did increase as we moved forward in time after 4, 5, 6 years, and the increase continued and expanded, that's very reassuring. It would have been unfortunate if we had seen it the other way around, if we had seen sort of a separation in the beginning and then a closing after 3 or 4 years, which has been seen in other prevention trials. So that's the way it looks actually is reassuring. You know, a couple things that could explain it that we wondered about but found were not true. The first thing we wondered is if adherence was poor in those first 3 years. You know, if adherence was poor, that could have masked the effect of tenofovir. But adherence did not vary during the years of the trial, so that didn't explain it. The other issue we wondered is, could there have been less risk behavior in those first 3 years, and therefore we really didn't see much of an incidence of HIV, and we didn't really detect it till later. But if you recall in those previous slides, risk behavior, or at least reported risk behavior, appeared to decline actually during follow-up, so that doesn't work. So then we're left, really the only explanation, and it's a reasonable explanation, is that it was a function of the power of the study. The study was not powered to show efficacy until we attained at least 40 infections. And in fact, at about 36 months, we only had about 25 infections. And if one or two, or more than one or two, but if two or three infections would have gone the other way, the curves would have looked more, they would have separated earlier and would have looked more like what you would expect. And, you know, chance is part of these trials. It happens that the two participants who were infected early on or at baseline were both in the placebo group. And after 36 months, the next 7 in a row were in the placebo group. So, we think it's likely just to do to the way the infections came in. So we don't know of any scientific reason why it wouldn't work in the first 3 years of participation. So that's that. About sex and whether transmission was through sexual activity or parenteral. So, you know, first thing is we don't have a test that gives us that answer. We don't have a test that tells us whether a person was infected through sex or through injecting drugs. But what we can say among participants in clinical trials in these clinics, and also in Thailand in general, but in these clinics, we did a preparatory cohort in the clinics that ran from 1995 to 1999, and then we had the AIDSVAX HIV vaccine trial that was done in the same clinics among people who inject drugs. In those two trials, when we looked at risk behavior, by far the strongest predictors of risk were injecting, sharing needles, incarceration. When we looked at sexual risk, in fact, those early trials, reporting that you had had sex put you at a lower risk of HIV infection, probably having to do with whether you were injecting heroin or not. When we've done the analysis we've done so far of the risk behavior in this study, we're seeing a similar type event, that the risk appears to be related to it, whether you're reporting you shared needles or injected drugs. And also the background heterosexual transmission in Thailand is very, very low. Incidence estimates are in the range of 0.02 or 0.03%, so about 2 or 3 per 10,000. So the underlying sort of sexual transmission in general is low, putting all that evidence together, that we are likely the predominant mode of transmission we're seeing is related to parental transmission. Not to say that, as Dawn has mentioned, it's likely that some of the participants of the trial became infected through sexual activity as well. And the good news about that is that we now know that tenofovir and Truvada can reduce the risk of both sexual transmission from the previous trials, and we would think from this trial, parental transmission as well.
Great. Thanks so much, Mike. Some additional questions have come in, but I want to see if anyone has questions on the line. You can hit *7 to unmute your line. Please introduce yourself and then *6 to mute again. So any questions from the line?
Yeah, Mitchell, it's Anna. Could I ask a question?
Yes, please, Anna. Go ahead.
Okay, good. This is very helpful information, and I appreciate especially getting information on the compensation because I think it's great to have data showing the positive effect that DOT can have on getting adherence. I wondered if the data were disaggregated by gender and if it was going to be possible to get specific data on the experience of women and the rate of seroconversion among women, the rate of adherence, et cetera. And part of the reason I'm interested in that is that, of course, all of us are very concerned about what happened with the adherence issues in FemPrep and voice, and I think we need to start thinking seriously and looking at the issues around gender differences.
So we certainly will be looking at that more closely in the upcoming months. What I can say we know now, we have looked at adherence, reported adherence, and their adherence among women was slightly better than men overall, but it's complicated. It looks like women tended to either adhere very well or not adhere or adhere very poorly, whereas men, the adherence, when you look at the data, it sort of slopes on up. So that the difference is not dramatic. It's very subtle. And because we have so many participants and so many days of follow-up, a small difference can be significant. But overall, women appeared to be slightly more adherent than men, and it was a significant difference. You know, our trial was not powered to show subgroup levels of efficacy. We really were just powered to show overall efficacy. It happens when we looked at it by subgroups, the distribution of women was strongly weighted towards efficacy. I think, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I believe among the 10 women or 11 women who became infected during the trial, I believe there were 2 in the tenofovir group and 9 in the placebo group. So it ends up having a very strong efficacy estimate for women, which is reassuring. But the numbers are so small, you know, 1 or 2 would make the difference there.
Right. Can I just ask a very quick follow-up? I wonder if you're planning to do a paper on that phenomenon of women's adherence being women adhering very well or very poorly. I think it would be extremely useful to have information from the women about what affected their adherence.
Right, so we do plan to do sort of an overall adherence manuscript, and that would certainly be part of it.
Great, thank you.
Great, thanks, Mike, and thanks, Anna. I do want to say that, excuse me, in the MMWR, the report from CDC that issued the guidance, they do have a very nice table that is available online that looks not only at the efficacy results from each of the PrEP trials, but also the adherence-related efficacy, and a very helpful tool. It doesn't provide the kind of detailed insights that Anna just described, but it certainly is helping to explain that adherence-efficacy relationship. Any other questions from the line again? Star 7, please, to unmute.
Am I unmuted?
You are. Go ahead. Oh, I think I heard Tim Farley, and I think I heard Kate Hankins.
You did. Let me let Tim go first.
Go ahead, Tim.
Okay, fine. Firstly, thank you very much, everyone. Congratulations on the study. It's a great achievement. Just a comment on adherence and then an issue about efficacy. Reading the paper, I see that the only objective measure of adherence is, in fact, drug levels. But they're only tested at exit, and you don't have drug levels during the study. When you say there was high adherence, in fact, it would seem from what you've said on the call that there was high distribution of drug with the daily pickup, but you've no idea whether, in fact, the drug was taken or not on those days. At least I think that's what I can deduce from what you said today. So I think it's going to be very difficult to tease out the effectiveness by adherence by time. The other issue is I was very intrigued by this lack of separation between the cumulative infection rates before 36 months and after 36 months. And then I looked at the web appendix and, you know, in table, I think it's S6 or something, numbers don't seem to match. The number of infections occurring in each of the years in that table don't seem to match the jumps in the cumulative hazard rate, as seen in the figure in the paper. And in fact, you know, there's one interval from 48 to 60 months in the TDF group where there are no infections in the appendix, yet there seems to be at least one infection. So my calculations on the basis of what's in the appendix show a separation, not a big separation, but at least some separation in the first 3 years. So I'm just wondering if you could either have a look at that in more detail as to whether, in fact, the total number of events seem to be right in the appendix and in the paper, but the figure doesn't seem to correspond to the appendix.
I don't have the appendix here in front of me. Let me just answer first about DOT and about the drug level testing. So thanks for those comments. I could have explained the DOT better. So when the volunteers came to the window, they were given a dose of study drug, and they took the dose right there in front of the window. So they took a dose, they drank some water, and then they left. So when we did DOT, we did see if they came to receive DOT, we did see them take study drug. You know, it's possible people didn't actually swallow it, but you know, we
Fine. That's excellent additional information. I didn't know that. That's
right.
Excellent.
So that's that. I also wanted to. So about the, I would need to look at the appendix to be sure. I mean, you know, the Kaplan-Meier curves. It's dropping the denominators and people. It should match up. But I'll look at that. Was there another question?
Yeah. No. I you just need to check that
I'm sorry.
The web appendix is less pessimistic than the figure.
Okay.
And by the way, my interpretation of the numbers is just random noise. That, you know, you've got
right.
Four numbers there, and
I mean, that,
that would seem to be the reason.
Right. That's what we ended up thinking. And about the drug level testing, that was the other question you mentioned. So there, you know, the logistics. We were hampered by just the logistics of we collected both plasma and cells. So the cells had to be processed within 4 hours. So to get specimens in the middle of Bangkok from a participant to a central lab to be aliquoted and then to our lab in Nonthaburi to be processed within 4 hours was an enormous challenge. And we just couldn't manage it during the study while we were trying to do everything else with our volunteers. So the best that we were able to do, we did collect cells and we collected plasma on all serial converters and processed those. And then what we decided is we would pick four clinics, which we picked four clinics, and at the exit visits, we collected plasma and cells on every single participant who exited the study at those clinics, both tenofovir, placebo, men, women, everybody. And so we have that data. We are just now beginning to go through those data to try to get more information to correlate, you know, study drug records along with the plasma and cells. So that's something we'll also be working on in the next few months.
Okay. No, that's interesting because you actually have exits that are occurring throughout the period of the trial. So you will have some information on plasma levels at different years since enrollment. So that's very good. Thank you very much.
Great. Kate, did you have a question?
Yeah, just very quickly. Your voice sounds terrible, Mitchell. But
I am well aware.
Okay, just to be really quick. I was wondering whether in the one-year follow-up that you're going to be doing now with study participants, with placebo recipients getting drugs and so on, whether you're going to offer any carry privileges. I don't know if those methadone clinics have carry privileges or you have to have it taken on-site for the methadone, but could you potentially do that? And my second question is, have you thought about incorporating in the next year some next step counseling techniques like were used in IPREX and seeing whether you can offer drug levels, albeit with a delay maybe of a month or two, as an adjunct to counseling?
As an adjunct to, I didn't hear what you said.
To counseling in that when a person comes back, you can basically say, you've only been here 4 times in the past month, and yet you have excellent drug levels. Where are you getting drugs? Are you getting on the street? Or, you know, you've got nothing in your drug levels, and we've been providing it to you. We've been watching you take it. It's linked up with this issue about whether you could allow some carry privileges for drugs for people.
It's a good question. You know, first, just to mention, we're going to be providing tenofovir to all participants, not just the placebo group. So whether volunteers were on placebo or tenofovir, they'll receive 1 year of tenofovir. And you know, there, you know, when you write the protocols for the open label studies, you don't have the benefit of the trial data at hand to make decisions on, you know, what laboratory testing we can do or we need to do. So we, now that we've just ended, now we do have the data. But when we wrote the protocol, we wrote it very simply. It's pretty much a trial continuation as the trial went. It's just that now everybody will receive tenofovir. So our goal is to very quickly sort of see what we can do to make adjustments. You know, I think your comments are very interesting, and to sort of gather as much information as quickly as you can. And then, you know, if we can get ourselves organized, put in an amendment and try to make subtle changes in the way we're conducting it. Right now, as I said, it's pretty much the same. We will be doing it dot in the clinics. We would sort of be interested in trying to provide it as a monthly, provide a monthly bottle of tenofovir for people to take. We ran, there were some concerns about safety for the volunteers, whether participants would come back for HIV testing or just, you know, would there be problems with resistance. Now we've shown, at least in our setting, that we didn't find any resistance, so that's reassuring. We may be able to make some changes in the way we're doing it in the months ahead, and that's what we would like to be able to do.
Okay, and just to say thanks so much for getting the study done. It's been a long haul, but people who inject drugs worldwide have been waiting for this. Thanks.
Thanks, Kate, and thanks, Mike. Actually, a question about monitoring, maybe, Dawn, for you. Given, and it came in on the web, given the now large data set looking at tenofovir in a number of different populations with seemingly no real difference in creatinine levels, is it still necessary to monitor renal function so frequently? And wondering if that is, could that change given the increasing amount of data as the guidance evolves over time? Oh, Dawn, star 7 to unmute.
Hi. Actually, we recommend monitoring renal function much less frequently than was in the trials. In the trials, it was monthly, and we recommend at least every 6 months. I think because the patients who are going to be receiving PrEP in clinical practice are not going to be as subject to the same rigid exclusion criteria of the trials themselves, it's important to get some information about whether there is any renal issue in patients who are taking it as part of clinical care and not a trial. And so until we have evidence that in populations that are not so heavily pre-selected, that it's safe to monitor it even less frequently, that's what our clinical consultants felt was a good starting place.
Great. Thanks, Dawn. And I wonder also on the issue of guidance, I don't know if anyone is still on from WHO, but they had issued their own guidance for developing demonstration projects with the results from both IPREX and partners. But wondering, as the CDC has been so quick to issue these interim guidance points after each of the trials, are you aware of other normative agencies, either nationally or multilaterally, that are looking to work with CDC to apply these in their own settings?
Internationally, South Africa is the only other country normative agency I'm aware of that has issued any guidance, practice guidance about PrEP. And that was not the government, but the HIV Care Providers Association of South Africa.
Exactly, yeah.
In the United States, we're working on our comprehensive guidelines, and we have participation from multiple professional societies as well as CBOs and academic partners in fleshing out the guidelines in some more detail. So I think we hope those will be published by the end of the year. I know that several states are working on developing their own practice guidelines for pre-exposure prophylaxis, but I'm not aware that any have been published yet.
Great. Thanks for that. Let me just pause. I know we're a little past the top of the hour, but we still have a lot of people online. any other questions from people on the line, you can hit star 7 to unmute your line.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hello? Okay, I just wanted to know, we use a coupon which allows participants to pick the needs and the same medium. How effective was this during the trial? Was there mixed up with people coming back to pick the wrong medium?
I'm not sure if Mike or Dawn or Daniel heard that. I wasn't clear on the question. Could you ask that one more time a little louder, please?
Okay. I said the use of coupon. I had one of the presenters talking about the use of coupon that allowed the participant to come back, pick the same meeting.
Ah, yes. Great.
Okay. So how effective was this?
Great question.
When participants come back to pick their meetings?
Great. Mike, do you have a sense of how effective those coupons were? Was there a lot of uptake for those?
Yes. You know, so what I heard, and I heard this in our meetings with our community group, was that this was in place, that there were coupons. It would identify a pharmacy that was willing to provide needles, and you'd get a coupon at the drop-in center, and you could go to the pharmacy and pick up a needle and syringe set. I think the way that it worked in that you would leave your needle and a syringe at the drop-in center and go pick up a new clean needle and syringe at the pharmacy. And, you know, volunteers or the people in the community group seemed to like this system. They thought that it worked well. It's sort of, you know, in Thailand, in Bangkok at least, it is it's sort of a different kind of situation because I think many people who inject drugs also identify pharmacies around town themselves where they feel safe to go and get clean needles. So it's an interesting situation, and you know, we weren't doing this in the study as part of the study, so I don't have any data on it. But it is, the community group said that they liked it, and certainly compared to, say, 7-8 years ago, these pilot, we wouldn't hear about this type of needle exchange program, and now we're hearing about it, so I gather that it is something that is at least popular enough that it is getting some uptake in the community.
Great. Thanks, Mike. I wonder, while we're on it, a question that's come up. Given the early controversies of the trial, particularly related to the lack of provision of clean injecting equipment, what has been the response from the Thai community in the last week or so with these results?
I guess, the results have just come out, so I don't think people have had much time to really sort of mull it over, think about it, and talk. So we'll be meeting with our community group this week, and maybe we'll get some more information. So I honestly haven't heard too much from the community yet.
And in addition to the community group that was involved in working with you, is the trial team or the Bangkok municipality or the Ministry of Public Health planning any additional outreach to some of the community groups beyond those involved in the trial to really talk about the results and about next steps?
Yes, we are. So we're working with the ministry to organize a meeting with other representatives, NGO groups. I don't know if a date has been set yet. I haven't seen a date, but I think we will be doing that in the next couple weeks.
Great. I do see, I think a hand is up. Mark, do you have a question on the line?
Sheena, it's Sheena here.
Oh, go ahead, Sheena.
Okay, yes, I just wanted to follow up with Dawn about the renal monitoring, because, you know, we give out antiretroviral therapy to, you know, triple therapy to people with HIV who are really quite sick, including tenofovir, without any renal monitoring. So I just really wanted to flag that with Dawn and say, please do go back to the clinical consultants and, you know, ask them to think again about this, because it adds to the complexity of the intervention to put in, you know, extra monitoring.
Great. Thanks, Sheena. I don't know, Dawn, if you have any thoughts on that. All right. We're going to wrap up in just a minute. I'm going to let each of the resource people provide some comments. So I'm sure that Dawn will comment on that, Sheena. So thank you. I do think there's a question. Mark Kinsley, do you have a question? *7 to unmute your line. All right. Perhaps, Mark, you don't. I think we do have some additional questions that have come in, but I'm very conscious of the time. I wonder, though, in just the last couple of minutes, if Mike, Dawn, and Daniel, if each of you have any last thoughts before we close up completely. Let me start with you, Mike.
I think in closing, the only thing I'd say is really to recognize that this project, this study, I mean, Kate was right. You know, we launched it in 2005. Here is 2013. We're finally presenting results. You know, volunteers in the study came day after day for many years, and it really wouldn't have been possible without tremendous support from the volunteers in the study, from the community groups that we worked with to accomplish a trial like this. And then also, you know, it's a very strong collaboration between CDC, the city government of Bangkok. We have about 300 staff working in the clinics. We're working side by side with them to make the trial work, plus a fantastic team at CDC. So I think all told, you know, it's probably about 3,000 people working pretty much day in, day out for the last 7 years to make this possible. And, it's just hats off to them. Tremendous, tremendous work. And, it's nice, very, very nice that we do have a good answer, an answer that really should have some good public health impact for people who inject drugs. So, and Mitchell, thanks for arranging the call tonight. Very, very good.
Great. Well, thank you, Mike. And we look forward because it is an exciting result. And like all the other PrEP results, they raise as many questions as answers and challenge us all to really do what you just described, to really translate those into public health impact. And we've all got a lot of work to do. But thank you and congratulations to you and the entire team. Dawn, who's been a tireless PrEP researcher and advocate for all this time, any additional thoughts from you? Dawn, *7 again. Oh, Dawn may have not be on the line. All right, well, if Dawn, you are on, hit *7. But let me turn to you, Daniel, from the Harm Reduction Coalition, a partner in pulling this together. Any additional thoughts or comments from you?
Sure, can you hear me?
Yes, please go ahead.
Yes, well, Michelle, I want to thank you and the AVAC team for all your work in putting this webinar together and all the interest from people around the world in this issue. I hope that this is a signal to restore the prevention needs for people who inject drugs to the mainstream of the HIV prevention discourse, whether we're talking about biomedical strategies, research approaches, policy and structural approaches. And I also want to acknowledge that as we've seen in the wake of results from the other PrEP studies, we do hear considerable ambivalence from the field of people working to prevent HIV among people who inject drugs about the fear that resources will shift away from the strategies and interventions that they're using to PrEP and what that implies for the prevention infrastructure at the community level. And I think that there's lots of good reasons for people working with MSM, people working with people who inject drugs, and people working with serious courting couples, women, and other populations at risk to start an internal dialogue about how we navigate the implementation questions of the results of these studies. And so I'm eager to participate in those kinds of dialogues.
Absolutely, Daniel. Such a critical point that as important and as good as these clinical trials have been in helping us understand oral PrEP for prevention in a range of different populations, it really only begins the conversation about what do we do next. Before we close, then, Dawn, are you still on? *7. All right, I think we must have lost Dawn. But I really want to thank Dawn and Mike and Daniel for all of the input and for all of you for being on the call. It is quite remarkable when one thinks about it that the trial has been going on for so many years. Many of us remember 2004 and the AIDS conference in Bangkok when PrEP was truly a dirty word. And the fact that we stand here now with evidence from so many different populations, so many different trials, beginning to weave an incredibly complex but important story in prevention. And I think it really is important to note that as we stand at 2013, this being the last of the tenofovir-based efficacy trials of daily PrEP, at least, that we have an enormous amount of work to do to understand what these results mean, what they don't mean, and most importantly, as Daniel said, what we will do with them in figuring out what can happen in the real world and what kinds of demonstration projects and implementation can we begin to do to translate efficacy, whether 49% or 74% with high adherence in this study or even 90% efficacy seen with adherence in other studies. How do we translate that into public health impact while recognizing that no one intervention is critical? One of the things we didn't really talk about on the call, although very important, is that although PrEP is clearly effective in preventing infection from now multiple routes, it won't prevent, for example, hepatitis C from needle injections. So it's important that we understand PrEP in the context of truly comprehensive harm reduction, and all of us, researchers, policymakers, advocates who work on PrEP or who work on harm reduction or who ideally now work on both, have a tremendous amount to do. But thanks to the Bangkok tenofovir study, we have some evidence on which to build additional demonstration projects and work ahead. So let me again thank Dawn and Daniel and Mike, and thank the thousands of Thais who really provided this answer, who make research happen. So thank you all. We will be posting a recording of the call online, and we will also provide a link to Daniel Wolf's remarkable Huffington Post piece that I encourage everyone to read. And keep those questions coming, and we will work with the researchers to be sure answers are back out to the community at large. So thank you all again, and have a great day or great night, depending on where you are.
Thank you. Please stand by.